This is a conversation with Sinan Rijal, Chief Commercial Officer at Netmind, who brings a sharp lens to building meaningful, customized AI solutions. Sinan shared how Netmind focuses on true product market fit and democratized AI, and I loved how he frames the global AI landscape from China's price-driven shift to the UK's unique strengths. Great. Very nice to meet you, Sinan. So thanks for joining the Humans and AI podcast. I've been reading a little bit, not a little bit, like a lot, about your background, what you've been doing. I've seen like you work across so many industries like clean energy, carbon capture, industrial autonomy, and now you are focused mainly in AI. Would you mind sharing a little bit about what personal experience, but also skills that you've developed through all these ventures? And then now you are the Chief Commercial Officer at Netmind.ai. So I would like to understand a bit of journey to get to this point.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for inviting me on floor. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm very much looking forward to our conversation today. So yeah, you're right. It's a slightly unconventional, perhaps, route. But I think there's a very powerful compass in me. And everyone may have their own compass. But for me, I'm always drawn by things with a big wow in them. And they have to have that, the wow test. The litmus test for me is, did the topic wow me? And what I mean by that is it something that's so big, so purposeful, and high potential in the impact it can have in the near term that I'm willing to give it my all? That's what drives me. And that's ended up defining these different industries that I've gone through. So everything from, as you pointed out, clean energy to carbon capture, to the early days of AI, autonomous mobility and autonomous vehicles, and now to really agentic AI is where I've emerged. And the skill sets, good question. I think I see myself as someone who is a venture builder who can do the A to Z of venture building. So having, and the only way to do that is by doing, really. So you pull up your sleeves and as a founder, you get in there and you build. And when you've done that and you've had to get involved in every aspect of the business, I think you develop certain skills around everything from conceptualization to ideation, team building, negotiation, marketing, sales. You have to have done all of it to really appreciate all of that. I wouldn't say there's one particular skill set, but there's a meta skill set that is around venture building and venture scaling. And that's, I think, what drives me.
That's great. I also checked that you've been a founder as well in a startup, right? Well, you already said a little bit about it, but what do you learn from that experience that now you are using as a chief commercial officer, Netmind.ai?
That's a really good question. With age comes wisdom, and that entrepreneurial journey is no exception. As you go through it, you learn through many mistakes, many dead ends, many wrong turns, and many moments of hubris. And you end up in a place where you look back and you see the path you've come through, and you can now see the world through a whole different, much more intricate, much richer lens that you can then bring to bear on new projects in a really interesting way. And there's no other way of getting here. You have to have gone through that route to get here. I think for me, the big all-time lesson that I use a lot right now is the idea of product market fit. And that to me is the be all and end all of good business, is especially coming from a deep tech background and having come through the primordial mix of universities and high tech folk and falling in love with technology first. I think that's where you learn your big lesson, is you make a mistake by falling in love with technology and not falling in love with the customer's needs. That I think is the one big thing that I take with me every morning, is what we're doing, is it something that someone desperately needs and desperately willing to pay for? Because that's the only thing that matters.
That's a very good advice, actually. Lesson learned, because I feel like talking with a lot of founders and CEOs, I feel like they love so much their technology or what they're building. But obviously the people who come through the podcast, they already got the market profit fit, because otherwise they would not be here. But it's true. I feel like it's all about people. So it's kind of like with the people who has the money, like people who makes the money and pay for their service because you're solving the problem. So it's a very interesting topic. Will you mention a little bit, what is your role? What do you do as a chief commercial officer at Netmind?
Netmind is a fascinating team and a fascinating venture. It's made up of very passionate AI enthusiasts and experts and scientists and people with a real love of AGI and a very big vision of getting closer to AGI. And in the process, that's how the company emerged. It was their own need to solve for AGI. And that's where they found the holes in their infrastructure, in their tools. And that's how Netmind came about. It is an end-to-end full service platform offering everything from GPU access right through to inference and so on, right up to agents, to allow people to build this emerging AI revolution that we're in. I think I came in specifically for the reason that I just mentioned. I think, if I'm being very honest, it was a team that were fully in love with their technology, fully in love with the concepts and the hypotheticals, but also self-aware enough and self-conscious enough to know that's not going to be what it takes to be commercially successful. And my job every day is to look at what we're doing and just make sure that in this extremely fast-moving industry, where really there are tectonic shifts on a sometimes hourly basis, you know, we stay not just afloat, but we thrive and we scale and we grow and we have something that is distinctly unique enough that it justifies the money that people pay for what we do. That's the sort of high level. Digging a bit deeper on that, what that really turns into is defining the strategy of the company, defining the go-to-market strategy for the company, working with people in product to shape what that product looks like, working extremely closely with the industry, with industries, with verticals, with customers, with potential customers, understanding what they're willing to pay for, what they're not willing to pay for, what their pain points are, what they don't really care about, and just making sure that we are right at the cutting edge and working in real time, that we're not lagging behind. Because in this sector, it just seems that if you lag for a short while, you're out.
Okay, you're like doing everything like the product, like a lot of marketing. Obviously, commercial is also related with the sales part and people for sure. Yourself as the leader of in the commercial area, how is the culture that you try to apply in your team?
That's such a great question. And something that we were literally in the midst of earlier today in a big meeting across the company. So it's multi-angled, really. I think the main thrust of our culture is one of, and this is a bit of a cliche, but I think it works. So therefore, the cliche stands. Is test quickly, fail quickly, iterate, and try again. And don't fall in love with something, with any product that you have or any technology that you have. Just keep listening. Listen. And that's a culture that we try and imbibe in every single member of the team. And we don't have a very big hierarchy at all. Every member of the team, young right through to the most experienced, gets together, listens to what everyone in the team has to say. And sometimes the best ideas come from the youngest, sometimes experience has something to say, but it's a culture of mutual respect across the team, but also this idea that anything goes, everything can be uprooted and upturned, and we should be willing to experiment and willing to try very outlandish things if that's what it takes to really stand out.
Okay, so basically startup culture.
every day. And we absolutely, very much a startup culture, yes.
Great. So I'm glad that you guys as well take the opinion of people that maybe they don't have that much experience, but maybe they come with innovation, right? They bring innovation, they bring a new, a fresh mind. So I think that's great. Sina, your company, Netmind, offers services similar to Google, for example. But you mentioned that your company is pioneering democratizing AI. So how do you guys do that? What is the difference that you do that to democratize that with, for example, Google is more like centralized provider?
Yes. I think what Netmind has to do differently is we are not in a position to fight the big behemoths in this space. And so you have to understand your industry and the playing field and the strategic environment you're in. And the AI environment is a uniquely, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's a it's interesting. At the same time as having democratized a lot of things for a lot of people, and we see the scale at which companies accelerate and grow. As we all know, OpenAI was the fastest company to ever scale in history at this level. Yes, everyone can have access, but at the same time, it also has the potential to create some of the biggest monopolies in history as well. That's the reality of the environment we're in. And we have to be careful that we are not playing second fiddle or catch up to one of these behemoths, because you're just in their sort of in the smoke from their exhaust pipe, and there's no hope in that. So we are approaching this in a very different way. And our approach is that where we can really make a difference is to get close to customers who are finding it very difficult to actually really use all these tools that are now at their fingertips. And as we've seen recently in a lot of studies and a lot of market analyses that are out there, the market is finding it very difficult to get really good returns on investment on all of these great LLMs and tools and applications that are now available. So that's where we come in. We offer really close, custom-tailored solutions for customers. And I think that's where we stand out versus some of the major big names. So that's where I think we have an opportunity, is to fill that gap between what's available out there on the shelf and what is a company's actual need.
Okay, great. Sina, do you follow any builder or innovator in AI that is related with your field or not, that you really admire and help you to push forward or inspire by the job that you're doing?
That's a very good question. Yes. Yes. I think someone that I find really interesting is Mustafa Suleiman, the head of AI at Microsoft and previously at DeepMind. And he has some very interesting theses on where things are going with AI. And I have to say that does influence a lot of my thinking on how AI is evolving, the potential for its benefits, but also the potential for its shortfalls. So that would probably be the person that I would nominate for this particular position.
Thank you. I appreciate your honesty, because sometimes I ask and people are like, I don't know what to say. I found it very interesting to listen to leaders who they follow, because obviously you need to read, you get information from somewhere to help you to your everyday, right? Because we are all humans, we all need this kind of push and that help us. We don't do this by ourselves. So I appreciate that you could say someone. So Sina, what is your perspective or what do you think about the AI societal role?
Yeah, so actually this links from your previous question. I think AI goes without saying that it has a huge AI potential. AI has a huge societal impact, or has the potential for huge societal impact, rather, is what I would like to say. And a lot of that is still shaping and taking form, but there are some things that are very clear and that we have to, I think, assess very honestly and take steps to try and mitigate or direct going forward. Things are moving much more quickly in reality, in technology, on the ground, in business, than I think in the world of policy. So policymakers are behind the reality of what is happening on the ground. And that, I think, has a lot of potential worries and concerns ahead. Now, I'm not a doomsday type of individual. I'm not a naysayer. I'm not a party pooper, whatever the term is. And I'm extremely positive about AI. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in this sector, and about what it can do for humanity. But the reality is that this is a very different form and kind of technological development than we've seen previously, in that it replaces our most powerful capabilities, which are our thoughts and our creative nature and our mental capabilities and capacities. And that's never been done before. So humans have always been complemented before with physical technological development that's helped them to magnify, multiply, enable themselves further. And AI does offer that potential, but it also, I think, fundamentally and critically offers an opportunity to displace us. And for centuries, I think these waves that have come before of technological innovation and development, we've said we've seen this before and we always come up with something to make up for this. But I think this might just be materially different this time. And so we need to have that discussion and talk about what that means for humanity going forwards and in society, that this has real major impact. Now, I know that impact has not come to bear just yet. And a lot of people who 2 years ago when OpenAI was just kicking off, there was a lot of scaremongering, a lot of worries that we're all going to lose our jobs. And the figures have not borne that through just yet. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen and that then there's not going to be this cavitation later of jobs, because I think it hasn't been implemented properly yet and it still needs time to take shape and people are still holding back. But the reality is this is fundamentally a whole different type of revolution. And with that come fundamental questions around how economics works, how a person's capability to earn works. I think a lot of formulae that we run our lives on will be challenged and jeopardized. And we'll just have to come up with new ways of resolving that. But it's going to have a major impact. It goes without saying. And once we move across from just pure on-computer software-based AI to physical AI and the emergence of robots and the emergence of autonomous vehicles and embedded AI, as it were, then that becomes even more palpable and even more critical.
Okay. Very interesting. By the way, talking a little bit about how globally things are changing, I saw that you mentioned something about how China is shifting the AI race from performance to price. So how do you see open source AI reshaping global dynamics?
Yeah, I think that's a major challenge to the prevailing model that was doing quite well for about a year and a half, 2 years, which was we could be moving towards closed models and again, monopolies. And mostly based in the West, if not just in the US exclusively, with a little bit in Europe, but mostly in the West. And I think the Chinese approach of taking a shot across the bow of the West and putting out these models and doubling down on them and being very pushing aggressively on that is a real challenge and a real competitive equation changer. I think it completely changes the field. And what that means, I think, is that everyone now has to play that game. Everyone has to be conscious of price and the field is leveling. So performance will end up, I think, leveling up. Everyone will have to have a certain level of performance just to be in the game. And then at that point, the margins become very thin. New business models will have to emerge. And this has again been done before. The whole internet was based on whole new business models around freemiums and all that, which didn't really exist that much before, I think. And now here we are. If we sell everything about ourselves for a free email or so. And I think that will have to replicate itself in some way. The game's not over yet. So this is all, we're not even at half time in this game. So we just have to keep a close eye. But it's a vicious and real competition. And I think China has come into this aggressively, knowing that this time and this wave, they can't afford to fall behind as they perhaps did with the internet.
Great. I actually, as a person, I talk a little bit about global, how AI is changing globally, not only in the West, the world. So it's very interesting to hear this. By the way, in your post about where is the UK's Mistral, what will a unique British AI ecosystem look like to you?
So the UK has a lot of great resources, assets, which are unique to it, and that it can leverage and should leverage to make sure that in this AI race, and again, we have to acknowledge this, we are in an AI race in the same way that obviously some draw parallels to an arms race, it is. And the reality is whoever owns and dominates in the space in the future will dominate on multiple levels. It's at the nexus of economics, politics, and much more. And I think it's critical that the UK gets its head around a strategy around this, a very clear strategy. And so the ecosystem there must leverage the fantastic university research base that exists. There's also multiple sectors that are there that are obviously, they're rooted in the UK. I'm thinking about finance, I'm thinking about banking, insurance in the City of London, where we are also based in Netmind, right in the midst of all that. And so leveraging all of that for research purposes and also for data and know-how. Plus, there's massive unique data sets in healthcare, for example, with the National Health Service that the UK has, which it can also leverage. So it's that mix of things. But what the UK really needs to be careful about, and it's made this misstep in the past with, for example, manufacturing, is these capabilities take a long time and a lot of effort to evolve and to take root in a country, in a geography, let's say, not necessarily even necessarily just a country, even in a geography. They can be removed very easily. You can remove a whole company to another country. You can move a manufacturing base. You can move offices. But once that happens, returning that is not so simple. So it's a unidirectional path-dependent situation where it takes a long time to develop, but can be very easily lost. And that they need to be very careful about that. The UK and policymakers need to be very careful about this. And the country must not turn into an incubator economy where it's just incubating great ideas. Or and that cliche around being an inventor but not being an innovator, this is something that has unfortunately, I think, cast a shadow over the UK in previous waves of technology development. So we've seen this in the past. And this time around, we just need to be careful this doesn't happen again. And all countries right now are in this situation where this musical chairs of who's going to end up dominating the space is happening right now. And countries that we didn't expect might end up being at the top of the table if this game isn't played right. Yeah, the UK needs to be very cognizant of this, very, very strategic about this. And it's not necessarily just about software or focusing on LLM models or AI models. It has to be a systemic view across the whole AI ecosystem and infrastructure. Everything from, for example, building specialist small nuclear plants that Rolls-Royce could be doing, for example, for data centers, of course, right through to various forms of physical AI and AI based on very specific niche industry applications or based on specific databases. So yeah, we need to take a systemic view on this, but there are definitely unique, differentiated capabilities, resources, and databases that we need to leverage to ensure that we maintain our own base and our own sort of pole in the world when it comes to AI.
Okay, thank you. So Sina, I've got a last question for you. So in all these craziness of the innovation, AI, and everything that's happening around the world, how do you personally stay grounded?
It's a very good question. If I can share something really personal, when I sit there and I take the long view and I worry myself about where things might be going, obviously I keep thinking of this dystopian world where I no longer interact with people and I no longer see real art or real forms of human created beauty. And there's two things to keep me grounded. One is talking to my kids about AI and trying to describe it. And in so doing, making sure that we understand the fundamentals of where all this is going towards. And through interacting with them, I think that keeps me very grounded about the realities of what's happening. Just trying to boil all this down to a child's language. That's one. The other is, I come from sort of Iranian roots. That's my ancestry. And I have an absolute love and passion for Iranian art and Iranian music and Iranian literature and poetry. And that to me is the epitome of the beauty that humans can create. So I indulge in Persian architecture, Persian history, Persian literature and poetry. And these are things that I'm sure right now cannot be replicated by AI. And that gives me some sense of a touchstone with reality and the beauties of what is real and what is human. Yeah, that to me keeps me grounded.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you very much, Sina, for this amazing conversation. I've learned a lot of what's going on around the world. So that's great. And thanks again for joining the Humans and AI podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Humans and AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human. One story at a time. See you in the next episode.